From KXJZ in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Many hundreds of birds are victims of the still mysterious oil spill off Southern California. Later in the hour, I'll talk with a UC Davis veterinarian who's involved in the rescue effort there. The rescue effort is being run by the Oiled Wildlife Care Network, which is headquartered at UC Davis. But first, a talk with best-selling writer John Lacroix. His new novel is The Motive. Coming up in a few moments, we'll hear an excerpt. But first, you should know that his latest book is a legal thriller called The Motive. Lacroix has written 16 novels, many of them New York Times bestsellers. He lives in Northern California, not a million miles from our studio in Sacramento. John Lacroix, thank you very much for coming in.
It's great to be here.
Well, I'd like to start with a reading from your new book, The Motive. It's from the first chapter about a big fire breaking out in a Victorian in San Francisco. The first two characters we meet are Fire Battalion Chief Norm Shackley and firefighter Al Daly, who's inside the burning house. Shackley radios Daly to tell him that ventilation is about to start working, which could be very dangerous.
Yes, if the smoke inside the house was hot enough, and no one knew if it was, the addition of oxygen to it might at this time cause a tremendous and often lethal backdraft explosion. So the initial attack squad waited in a kind of suspension down the front steps out in the street until a minute and 40 seconds later, the smoke column spewing from the roof suddenly exploded into a fireball that lit the night for blocks around and rose to heights of 100 feet and more. By now, the first hoses had been attached to the hydrant at the corner, and eight firefighters on each of a couple of them were blasting 600 gallons of water per minute into the open space. For all the apparent good the firefighters were doing, they might as well have been standing around spitting on the flames. But appearances in this case were deceiving. The hydrant water was lowering the temperature sufficiently so that Daly and his squad could advance again into the building. Because of the ventilation, the smoke that filled the foyer had now begun to dissipate upward, as did the thick cloud of steam generated by the water from the hoses. Within a few seconds after the hose team stopped soaking the entryway, Daly and his squad were back at the front door. With his night helmet's beam on and glowing, he had relatively clear sight lines through the foyer to the house beyond, to the flames still licking at the walls on all sides. Wielding his Akron, spraying in a wide arc, he advanced into the darkness, following the beam on his helmet. All around was noise and chaos, the rush of air behind him as the conflagration sucked it in, the roar of the actual fire, the creaking and splintering of wood, the hail of axe blows, disembodied voices yelling both within and outside the building. Daly sprayed and advanced, 1 foot or so at a time. The foyer was circular, high-ceilinged, and quite large, perhaps 14 feet in diameter. He could make out the shapes of burning furniture along the walls, what appeared to have been a coat rack, a sideboard, maybe an umbrella stand or wastebasket. Drapes over a couple of windows, curved to the shape of the house, were all but incinerated. One opening to Daly's right led into another open room, and directly ahead of him another doorway fed into a hall. Everywhere he looked, there was flame, total involvement of the ground floor. Despite the hoses soaking, the fire was growing again, heating up. It was excruciatingly hot, dangerously hot. Daly felt a sloshing like water in his ear, but knew that it wasn't water. It was his earwax, melting. He had to get out of here right now. He wasn't going to be able to check for potential rescue victims until the fire died somewhat, and by then, by now, he knew, anything living in the structure would have died as well. Still, he pushed forward, forcing himself for another step or two, spraying as he went. It was full night, his only light his helmet beam. Looking down at the entrance to the hallway, he suddenly became aware of two shapes that stopped him where he stood. Leaning in for a closer look, not that he needed it, he forced himself to speak in his most neutral tone. "There's two bodies in here, Norm, in the foyer." Out in the street, the second alarm units had begun to arrive, and Shackley was issuing orders to 9 people at once back by the rehab station, which itself was already nearly overwhelmed, supplying drinks, fresh air bottles, and first aid. He asked Daly to repeat what he'd just said, and he did, adding, "No ambulance needed," which meant they were obviously dead. Shackley took only another second to process the information, then turned and spoke to his operator aide, who functioned as gopher in the field. "Find Becker," he said, and put in a call to homicide.
That's an excerpt from the first chapter of The Motive, the new novel by John Lacroix, and he's my guest today on Insight. John, there are such dramatic details there about fire. Do you have personal experience of fire, or was this research, or just good old-fashioned imagination?
Well, I got some experience doing my research. It was a very great time. I talked to a buddy of mine who lives in Davis named Josh Marone, who's a firefighter in Santa Rosa. He introduced me to his chief, Chaz Hanley, down in Santa Rosa. I learned a lot from those guys down there, arson guys and everything else. And then I said, well, that's nice, but I need to know about San Francisco. Do you know anybody there? Well, it turns out Chaz happens to know Tom Siragusa, who is the assistant chief in San Francisco. So I made an appointment. Tom was happy to see me. I went down. The day I got there, I walked into the station. You're not going to believe this. It's almost like I was an arsonist myself. But I walked into the station, and the first thing that happened was the alarm went off. And I'm mixing him up with the character, but Siragusa hands me a fire helmet and says, we're going, let's go. And so we hopped on a fire truck and went and fought a fire.
Were they worried about liability?
It was pretty cool, I have to say.
I can imagine. Who told you about the sound of earwax melting?
Well, this is in a book called Working Fire, which is about the San Francisco Fire Department, and it's a common occurrence. I mean, I've talked to several firemen who've had it, and it's kind of scary. Even if they've got their helmets on and everything else, you know, it gets really hot.
And that presumably is a bad sign if your earwax is melting.
You want to get out of there. You want to get out of there quick. Yeah.
I want to talk a bit more later in the program about where you get ideas for books and how you work up the ideas for books. But since we're talking right now about the motive, where did that start? Did it start with the idea of a fire?
Yeah. I knew this is a strange book for me because often I don't find out who my bad guy is until I'm well into the book. But this book, I had an idea of who I wanted the bad person to be. And so I had a very clear idea of the crime early on. Long before I started writing. And I knew that the bodies would have to be incinerated to make the crime work. So I knew it was going to have to start with a fire.
You said that you often don't know who the bad guy is until you're well on in the book.
Right.
How does that work? Is that scary to be writing a book about a bad guy?
It's very terrifying to me because I'm a very type A guy. You know, I'm not, quote, the artistic temperament, really. I go in and work every day just like it's a job. And what I do is basically magic to me. I'm waiting for that genie to appear every day and start whispering in my ear. And you know, some days he doesn't show up.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
Does that mean then that you... Now, let me rephrase that. Are you not inclined to change that way of working, of not knowing who the bad guy is necessarily when you start the novel? Does it feel like it's good luck to not know, or does it just happen that way?
Well, there's been, I think, 16 books now, and about half the time I haven't known, and about half the time I know. And the book I'm writing right now, that'll be out next year, I don't know.
When you look back over your 16 novels, half of which you knew who the bad guy was at the beginning and half you didn't, can you see any patterns in the books as they evolved, given the dramatically different way in which you approached it?
You know, interestingly, no. They're very similar. The books tend to be organic, and if you've done it right and you tell the story correctly, you can either write up to an expected conclusion, or more commonly, you write up, you fill in all around it, and you make all of the other red herrings inherently plausible. So that at some point in the book you say, which is the most satisfying solution out of the many, all of which would work. So you just pick the one that's most satisfying. I do. That's how I do it.
My guest is novelist John Lesquois. His new book is The Motive. Could you tell us a bit more about The Motive to the extent that you can tell us something about a thriller?
I'm not going to give anything away. This is a book that really, I think, it's one of my favorite of all my books, and it's become more of a favorite since I've finished it because, for some reason, it has an incredible combination of plot and character, and rarely have I had it happen in my books that plot and character have melded in such a satisfying way. There are personal issues with both of my main good guy characters that feed into the plot in a very holistic, wonderful, I think, very good way. And the book ends in a very satisfying manner. And it also ends in Davis, which is really fun because all my books are in San Francisco almost all the way through. And when I got to the end of this book, I just decided to, rather than go and do research down in like Coalinga or someplace I didn't know, I needed a relatively unknown small city. And Davis fit the bill perfectly. And so it was a lot of fun and very easy to write for me.
You talked about how this was a different book for you, and you talked about the development of character. Is there an evolution in your novel writing style as time goes by?
Yeah, I think definitely. One of the things that happens is you get confidence in the characters, and you let I have let them become a little bit more, I don't want to say outrageous, because they're definitely not outrageous human beings, but they have a lot more fun. The dialogue between my two guys, I think, is just, they just start, you know, ripping on one another, and it's very funny, I think, and most of my readers find it pretty entertaining.
You're a well-known novelist. You've had quite a lot of bestsellers. You're printed in many languages. You've been a full-time novelist, I guess, for about 15 years
or
so. Yeah. How is the books business today, and how does it compare to when you got started as a novelist?
Oh, there is no comparison on any level.
Apart from that?
Really. I mean, aside from the book coming out, and that's about the only thing it had in common. I mean, now my publisher's, the first printing on The Motive, I believe, was 140,000 books in hardcover. And the first printing on Dead Irish, which is the first one in this series, well, if it was 2,000, that's a miracle. And there's, you know, a very large campaign, full-page ad in the New York Times, you know, a huge advertising campaign with 450,000 little tiny pamphlets printed that they gave out in all the Lowe's theaters through the month of December across the country. I mean, it's a big marketing deal. And plus, I've been on the road touring for the last 3 weeks, and we'll do it for another two.
The other aspects of the media world, if we include publishing in the media, are dealing with a dramatically changing environment. There are so many options that people have nowadays for their entertainment and for their culture.
Sure.
And the digital access to works is changing the economics of many media.
Yeah.
How is the books business being affected, A, by the dramatic, the big escalation in choices for people and digital delivery?
Well, you know, I don't think those two things have too much of an impact, frankly. I think people still like the old-fashioned feel of getting a book, holding it in their hands, and reading it. The digital impact is minuscule, except for the fact that I think they buy books on Amazon more often than they, you know, could have done in the past. But I really think, and this is a very interesting question, because when I was younger, one of the things that kept me from pursuing a career as an author was that I didn't believe people would be reading in 30 years, that is, now. And now, I believe that people will be reading in 30 years, and that's a big difference. The world, I think, does need some, I mean, you have to take some downtime and sit down with a book. There's nothing like it.
This is Insight from KXJZ. When we return, more conversation with my guest, the novelist, John Lesquaw. We'll be right back. This is Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callis, and you're listening to John Lesquaw, the novelist. His latest book is The Motive. He's also a musician. This track is from a CD, As the Crow Flies. John, what's the song called?
It's called Songs of the South, and it's a trip to hear it on the radio.
Yes.
That was a surprise. You got me.
Yeah, well, good.
That's good.
How important is music to you?
Oh, it's a huge part of my life. I love it.
What do you do?
Yeah, I play. In fact, my wife just gave me for my birthday. My birthday was on Friday. And she just gave me my first electric guitar. I got a Fender Strat that I just am thrilled with. I can't seem to stop playing it. But other than that, everything's fine. I should go back in and start typing, but I'm playing a lot more than I have been.
How often do you play in public? This is a CD.
Well, you've got
two CDs out, in fact, I believe.
Yeah, I have two CDs. I play in public rarely, once a year, twice a year, something like that. You know, I used to do it every day when I was, before I was 30, I was a full-time player. And, it's a wonderful thing to do, and I love to do it. And if I wasn't an author, I would be playing quite a bit.
It seems like a lot of novelists have this interest. I know Stephen King and Dave Barry also play.
Oh, sure. Rock Bottom Remainders. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, I was with them last year on the stage at the Fillmore West. And I must tell you, the high point in my career thus far was I won the Louie Louie contest.
Meaning I
don't even know the lyrics to Louie Louie, but I got up and sang them, you know, and the Rock Bottom Remainders backed me up, and I killed it. You know, it was pretty good.
Oh, that must have been a trip.
It was a trip.
Let's go back to when you committed yourself to being a full-time writer. I believe it was in 1989.
That's about when I started the Dismas Hardy series. I'd written three books before then, and they'd all failed in terms of commercial appeal.
Did they fail from your point of view?
The first one won the Joseph Henry Jackson Award for Best Novel by a California Author, so I felt good about that. But it was... a commercial total bust. It was not even published in hardcover. And the second two were Sherlock Holmes pastiches set in World War I. And they're still, they're still in print today, and they're very successful books. But back then, they were just disasters.
Well, what changed?
What changed? You know, that's the $64,000 question. I wrote the first two of the Dismas Hardy books, and they got very nicely reviewed and, in fact, nominated for Best Novel. The first one was. But nobody bought them. Nobody bought them. And it was a very difficult time for me and my family. I was making no money. And at the most, you'd get $10,000, and that was paid out over a 3 or 4 year payout.
So you didn't have a day job at that time?
Oh, I had nothing but a day job. I was working as a word processor down in Los Angeles, 8 hours a day and then 4 hours at night. Working, typing for other law firms around in the towers of L.A.
And that job was intended to support your writing habit.
Yes, right. I got up at 5 o'clock in the morning. I mean, this is the glamorous, romantic writer's life. I got up at 5 in the morning. I had two little kids. I had to support them. My wife was working as an architect, making $10 an hour, and I was working as a typist, making 17. And I got up early and went out to my garage and typed my books. For 2 hours.
What sustained you during that time? You've got kids to support. You've got a typing job. Your first few books aren't going anywhere. What motivates you? What keeps you going?
What motivates me? That's a great question. I was just, I think everybody has a vision of who they are. And my vision, A, did not include failure, and B, included writing. And so I just kept trying and kept trying to get better and kept trying to figure out what was a commercial. And I don't mean that in a crass way. I mean, what was the key that would unlock that readership? And what it turned out to be, I think, in my case, is when I wrote the book Hard Evidence, which is the third book in this series, I had taken Dismas Hardy, my main character, away from being a bartender, which is what he'd been in the first two books. But luckily, I had made him a lawyer in his past life, and he was a burned-out lawyer, and he was bartending. So for the third book, I brought him back to the law, and that gave me, number one, a very big palette. I didn't want to write a little mystery. I wanted to write a big novel about life. And so instead of just trying to solve a simple mystery, I was writing suddenly about characters and about real, husbands and wives and motivating forces and all kinds of stuff that I had never written about before. And the public, it took them, not too long, actually. That book sold in Japan and Germany for really quite a big advance, and that changed my life. And the one after that was The 13th Juror, and that became a big international bestseller. And since then, they've all been. So it's wonderful.
You said you had a bigger palette with that book. Was that Did that just happen, or were you actively seeking this bigger palette so that you could be more successful, you could earn a real living as a writer?
Well, you know, it wasn't that, I can't say it was that thought out. It was a little more holistic in the sense that I just started writing it. I wanted to write, I knew I had to write a bigger book, a bigger, a more important, if you will, book. And I already had two in this series with these characters. I mean, I'd started them and I knew who they were. And I just, when I got to a point in a scene or when I got to a point in the beginning of a day or wherever it was that I wanted to start writing the next thing that happened, I tried to write about why it happened more than what happened. And doing that opened everything up. People became funnier, livelier. They did unexpected things for me. I didn't try to close it up and follow a path down to the end. I tried to open it up and just see where it led. And that's the change.
What would you say to the legal typists of today who are trying and not yet succeeding in being a full-time novelist? What would you tell them that you learned from your own experience of when things started to change?
Well, you just can't stop writing. You can't stop trying to make the book as good as you can make it, whatever you may be doing. It's very interesting you should mention this legal writer's thing because, you know, I had a word processing department that I ran in L.A., and there were 22 of us at the high point of the firm. And out of the 22 of us, I believe something like 7 or 8 of us are all now successful creative people. 2 or 3 are famous actors. 2 or 3 are definitely many times published authors, and several have written successful screenplays.
It's part of the myth of Los Angeles.
It is part of the myth, but this turned out to be, well, maybe it was because I was hiring these people, and, you know, I picked people who were smart and were, you know, had a little bit something else going for them, aside from their fingers being able to type 120 words a minute.
My guest is the novelist John Lesquois. His new book is The Motive. I read that you had a very serious illness in the late 80s, around about the time that things were about to start changing for you. What happened then?
Well, this was really, this was right before this big palette moment, as we had. I had just finished The Vig, which is the second book in his Hardy series, and I went body surfing at Seal Beach and got wiped out, as you usually do when you body surf. And the next morning, I woke up with an earache, and by the middle of that night, I was delirious, and my wife took me down to the hospital emergency room, and they told her I had 2 hours to live. I had spinal meningitis.
That's tough news to get.
It was tough. She had a 19-month-old baby and a 5-month-old baby in her arms, I mean, at 4 o'clock in the morning. And they said, you know, find a funeral home. This guy's toast.
How conscious were you?
Not. I was not. I mean, I was awake for that, and then about a few, maybe another hour later, I was awake for the spinal tap they did to do the final, you know, analysis or diagnosis. And they said, yep, well, spinal meningitis and really well advanced. It's over. And for some reason, I didn't die. I was more or less in a coma for 11 days.
Did you start to check out at that kind of news?
No, actually the opposite happened. Lisa came up to me, my wife, and said, they said, you have spinal meningitis. And I said, wait a minute, people die from spinal meningitis. Mm-hmm. And she said, well, the doctor said you were not going to. And I said, good. She said, but they said, stay awake.
Really?
Yeah. So I said, okay. And I stayed awake. I forced myself to stay awake about 3 hours. And it was painful. Let me tell you, spinal meningitis is the worst headache you've ever heard or felt in your life. And, you know, I didn't die. I mean, it sounds weird, but then what happened was, is when I came out of that experience and realized, you know, that I was 41 years old now and, you know, I wasn't doing everything I needed to do with my books. I needed to, number one, make them successful and number two, make them better. And so I just came up here and I wrote a book in 3 months.
Do you think that experience with near death actually helped move you in the direction that you're now in?
Without a doubt. Yeah. I mean, it was very traumatic. I mean, it was traumatic recovering. Was hard on really hard on my wife. But, you know, she's a trooper. She was great. And we just stuck it out together. We have been very connected, you know, through all this time. And, you know, she's a big part of why I'm able to do what I do.
Do you still surf?
Ha! You know, I'm not a big surfer anymore.
meningitis can do that.
I don't know. I'm just not that big a surfer. I do a little bit of skiing, although everybody else in my family is a much better skier than me. And I keep active. I do a lot of sports, but I don't surf.
Why did you move to Davis? You said you moved after the meningitis.
Yeah, we were in Los Angeles while all this was happening. And Los Angeles just stopped working, basically. I woke up after this and said, I don't want to be here anymore. I got to be in, you know, a little bit of God's country. So we moved up here. I set my books in San Francisco. Lisa is on ski patrol up in Sierra. So it's midway in between them, and it was a great place to move to.
I'm talking with the novelist John Lesquois. His new book is The Motive. Which would be the first of your books you'd give to someone wanting to check out your work?
Well, you know, I always start them with Hard Evidence because that's the first one with the big palette. And if they like that book, and they will, they can go back and read the first two when Hardy was a younger man and he was a bartender, and you can get all the background of how he met his wife and all that fun stuff. But just as a read, I would definitely say Hard Evidence. And then you can just keep going up till today, and you know, you'll enjoy them all. I mean, they're all really pretty fun reads. Yeah.
Let's talk more about the writing process for you. You're quite a disciplined worker.
Yeah,
I hear.
Yeah, I'm a disciplined worker.
Yes. So what does that mean?
I just came from my office for this interview, and I was writing today. You know, so
what's a typical day then?
Today was typical. I get up at 6:30, get breakfast for the kids. I have two teenage kids. I believe in being an active father, that really the father role is the most important role I have now, much more than novelist. So I try to be a good dad, got them off to school. Then I went and worked out for a couple hours in a club because otherwise I'd be a sedentary fat rat and I don't want to be. Then I was in the office about 10 o'clock, turned on my computer, started writing.
And do you have a goal for each day in terms of number of words, number of pages?
Yeah, well, I'm failing that goal miserably. I've been very good at it. But for some reason, this new book I'm writing, I'm experimenting with a new character that it's going to be within the Hardy Glitzky framework. But he's a different kind of a guy. And I'm really, really having trouble waking him up. I'm slapping him around and trying to get him to do something. And he's not showing up as often as I'd like. So
how do you get your characters to do something? Is it a process of writing and seeing what happens, or do you figure it out beforehand?
You know, Oakley Hall is a great writer in San Francisco. He says you just do it by the seat of your pants, and that's the truth. You just write your way out of it. You just keep going. You just keep piling up pages until somebody does something interesting. And, you know, I'm getting a little mad at my guy, you know, and I might have to really, you know, I might have to do a little physical damage on him.
You said piling up the pages until someone does something interesting. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're being a little tongue-in-cheek, I guess.
No, I have thrown away probably 240 pages on this new book.
Well, that was going to be my question.
Yeah.
Does that mean you actually throw them away?
Yes. I've written them, looked at them, and said, this is just dog do. I'm not going to keep this in the book. Nobody's going to want to read it.
Is that a cul-de-sac in the book, or is that an actual book that you could throw out 240 pages of?
I've started this book, this particular book that I'm going to be handing in on May the 1st.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that's coming up pretty soon. I've started this book 7 times. Completely started it, over.
How many, with a total of 240 pages?
At least. This has been a hard one, I have to say. I mean, I've done that kind of thing once before on my book, Guilt, which, you know, is one of my most popular books and is, you know, really turned out very well. But I threw away, God, I want to say 300 pages of Guilt before it finally started to wake up and come alive.
How does that feel?
It's awful. It's panic. It's just like, you know, the genie I was talking about earlier in the show, you know, I mean, he's just not been showing up. And, you know, I'm mad at him, too. And meanwhile, it's like, you know, it's almost like you're a baseball player. You know, if you try harder, you're going to choke. So you kind of always have to just be, oh, well, I just got to go up and relax and try again today.
How do you know the genie didn't show up? Is it possible that you're not seeing something that maybe your audience would like, or vice versa?
Yes, that's possible. But I got to trust my instincts. You know, I mean, I got to laugh and I got to be tickled by this stuff. And the guy's doing stuff, but he's nothing special. You know, he's nothing special. I got to have a special guy show up.
You said you keep writing until someone does something interesting. Does that apply for the beginning of the book, or
It better apply mostly at the beginning of the book.
Yeah.
Because, you know, the beginning of the book is all somebody's going to read. If you don't get them, if you don't have something fun or cool happening, you're dead. You know, nobody's going to want to continue.
Does that mean at the beginning of the book, the very beginning of the book, that you're just sitting down with an open mind, a clear mind, and
yes,
starting to type?
Sometimes you just think of, I mean, I really like this. It's an exercise, but I like to sit down and write up really cool first lines. My book, for example, it's out now in paperback called The Second Chair, and it's a New York Times bestseller right now. I'm very happy, and everybody should go buy it immediately. But that first line of that book is something like, 4 minutes remained in the life of Laura Riley as she pulled out of the, as she came out of the bathroom in her, you know, San Francisco apartment.
Yes.
And bingo. I mean, you know, you're going to read that book.
Do you have a list of?
Yeah,
cool
I got
lines?
A list of, you know, 100 really good first lines, of which I've used, you know, 13 or so.
Can you tell us anything about the book that you're working on that you started 7 times?
Yeah. I've finally determined that I know the name of it. It's called The Hunt Club. And it has a lead character named Wyatt Hunt. And he's a very good guy. I've got 60 pages now that I'm clear about on him. That's the first part of the book, and it's his background, where it leads up to the beginning of the book. And then the book begins with the disappearance of a woman lawyer in San Francisco. That's it. She just disappears.
Why do you write legal thrillers? Is that something that you always enjoyed reading, or did you just find that you were good at it?
No, I don't enjoy particularly reading them. I'm not a big fan of the genre. I really, in spite of the marketing that they do, many of my books don't have any courtroom scenes at all. They just always market them as though they do.
And they're Law and Order types.
They're crime stories. And I am interested in crime because crime is conflict and suspense. And I love working with the idea of what crime does to normal people. So I'm not like the serial, I don't go into the mind of the serial killer type thing, and I don't write gore and all that stuff. What I find fascinating and completely interesting is the way that crime intersects with the lives of people who are not involved with crime.
How do you motivate yourself to write so many books in a genre that doesn't particularly interest you as a reader?
I don't write the same kind of books that I don't read.
You're
I mean, that's the best
yourself.
Way to put it. Nothing to take away from guys like, you know, Steve Martini and Sheldon Siegel. I mean, both talented, really good writers. But I myself write a very personal book. My guys are, I like to think of my books as kind of like the Aubrey Maturin series. You know, the Patrick O'Brien guy, and he wrote his two guys on a ship for 22 books. And I have my two guys in San Francisco for now 13 books. And I hope I'm going to write another 10 or 12.
The kind of book you write is sometimes colloquially known as a page turner.
Oh, yeah.
How do you approach writing a page turner? That seems to me to be surely a tricky thing to do, to write something that can hold people's attention so that they keep turning pages.
Well, I don't try to do that. I try to just tell a story that is so compelling that you want to know what happens next. And I think this is something that's changed in, quote, literature over the past 50 years, because back in the old days, say the 50s, you know, before that even, Hemingway wrote page turners, you know, and he won the Nobel Prize. Steinbeck wrote page turners. He won the Nobel Prize. It wasn't always about extraordinarily obtuse language being what was considered literature. And, you know, I really hearken back to that kind of method where I'm just trying to, you know, use really good words, appropriate words. I like to think I care about the words, but I also care about the story. If you don't have a story, who cares about the words? And that's frankly the problem I have with quite a bit of quote highbrow literature. There's really nice poetry there, but it doesn't tell a good story.
I'm talking with the novelist John LeSquire. Let's hear one more excerpt from your new book, The Motive. This is also from the first chapter. We're still at the scene of the opening fire, and arson investigator Arnie Becker is looking for clues.
The fire still raged in the back of the house and on the upper stories. The two manned fire hoses at the front door snaked across the floor of the foyer and disappeared out the right-hand doorway somewhere back into the inferno. Becker, now suited up in his turnout coat and night helmet, his Scots down over his face, also held a wide-beam flashlight that he trained on the bodies. He squatted like a baseball catcher, having learned that to put a knee on the floor was an invitation to pain and suffering. The clothing had been burned off where they had been exposed, but even though both figures were lying on their backs, he couldn't tell what sex either had been. One was larger and one smaller, so they were possibly a man and a woman, but he wouldn't be sure until the coroner was finished with them. The hair and any distinguishing characteristics on the faces likewise were burned away. Something in the resting attitudes struck him, though. He had seen many dead people before, the victims of fire, as well as victims of murder and or suicide, who were at fire scenes but dead before they burned. In his experience, the bodies of people who died from fire or smoke inhalation, as the blaze grew around them, tended to curl protectively into a fetal position. Victims of murder or suicide most often lay as they fell, and these two bodies fit that profile. There was still the characteristic drawing up of the extremities as the flesh cooked, but it did not strongly resemble the curled-up bodies he'd seen of victims who died by fire and fire alone. Suspicious by nature and now by circumstance, Becker reached for a flashlight-like device he wore on his belt, the multi-gas-detecting AIM-3250. Turning it on, he waved it down the sides of the smaller victim, the one nearest to the front door, and wasn't exactly stunned to see that it registered the presence of gasoline. So, Becker thought, this was probably arson, and from the attitudes of the bodies, it was quite possibly a murder or a murder-suicide as well. Becker tucked in his gas detector, then trained his flashlight again on the smaller body in front of him. Directly over his head, a deafening crash shook the building and rained charcoal down over him, but he barely heard or noted it. The small and perfectly round hole, high in the back of the head, above and behind where the ear should have been located, it had burned away, commanded all of his attention. Stepping over the smaller torso, Becker moved over the still squishy rug, squatted and shone his light on the other victim. Tucked under the side of the torso, a glint of metal shone up when his beam hit it. Becker wasn't going to touch anything at this point, but he lowered his light's trajectory and saw enough to realize that he was looking at the barrel of a gun.
That's an excerpt from the first chapter of The Motive, the latest hardback by novelist John Lacroix. John, you're working in another book right now that you said is due on May 1st. What about after that? What's the long-term picture for John Lacroix?
Well, I'm fortunate. I have a three-book deal with my publishers, Dutton. The one that I'm writing now is due May 1st, and the one after that is due the next May 1st. And I hope I get another three-book deal after that. So I love what I do, and I hope to keep doing it forever.
John Lacroix, thank you very much for coming in.
Good. My pleasure.
That's novelist John Lacroix. This is Insight from KXJZ. When we return, I'll talk with Dr. Michael Zaccardi. He's a veterinarian at UC Davis, and he's helping rescue birds that are victims of the mysterious oil spill off Southern California. We'll be right back. This is Insight from KXJZ. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Many hundreds of birds are victims of the still mysterious oil spill off Southern California. Birds with oil on their feathers are vulnerable. It's hard for them to fly, float, and swim, and they can also lose body heat. The rescue effort is being led by the Oiled Wildlife Care Network. It's headquartered at UC Davis. Heading the network is Dr. Michael Zaccardi. He's a veterinarian at the UC Davis Wildlife Health Center, and he joins us by phone from the Bird Rescue Center in San Pedro. Michael Zaccardi, thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Jeffrey.
How many birds have you and others plucked out of the water and off the beaches so far?
We have just over 1,000 birds that have been collected live and brought to the San Pedro facility here.
All alive?
All 1,000 of those are alive. Unfortunately, approximately 200 animals have died in the environment. They've also been brought here.
And when you say animals, are you referring just to birds, or are there otters and other creatures?
Well, those 1,200 birds or so have all been birds. We do have the ability to capture marine mammals as well. If they do come in, if they are oiled, we can send them to other facilities which can care for them.
Now, you're a veterinarian, a wildlife veterinarian, and you can't comment on what exactly the oil spill is about. But just for the benefit of our listeners, I should note that the source of the oil spill is still basically mysterious. There are several possible sources for the oil spill, relating in part to the floods that happened last week in Southern California. And Dr. Michael Zaccardi of UC Davis is helping supervise the care of birds injured in the oil spill. What exactly do oil and other petroleum products do to birds?
What they do primarily is these animals being coated with oil, it can cause them to lose their waterproofing. So in the environment, they get cold. When these animals get cold, they tend to come up on shore. When they're on shore, unfortunately, they can't eat. Therefore, they can succumb to the oiling unless they're collected and provided appropriate care at our specially designed facilities.
They start to get cold in the water when they have oil on their feathers. Tell us a bit more about what happens, why the oil interferes with their ability to stay warm.
Well, both birds and marine mammals, they use their fur or feathers almost like a dry suit for us. So what that does is that traps a layer of air between the feathers and the skin. That layer of air keeps them warm in the cold environment. If there's oil on that feather, what it can do is, in essence, make a rent in the dry suit. Cold water can get in, and the animals can become hypothermic or get a low body temperature due to that rent in their dry suit.
And the Pacific Ocean is, of course, quite cold.
Yeah, very cold in areas.
How long would a bird or other animal with oil on its fur or feathers last in the Pacific Ocean around this time of year?
Well, animals, if they are impacted by oil, they really only have a few days before they can succumb to hypothermia in the environment, which is why it's extremely important to have pre-identified facilities, pre-trained staff and volunteers, and equipment ready to go at a moment's notice should an oil spill occur.
Is it hard to fly, too, when you have oil in your feathers?
Absolutely. Depending on the coating, most animals, if they're heavily coated with oil, they cannot fly, and so they don't have the ability to escape the oiled area. So most of these animals are actually floating in on the currents until they reach the shoreline.
When we think of marine creatures, it's one of the first things that comes to mind is the bird pecking away at its feathers and the marine mammals, you know, preening themselves. That is in part to preserve the warming effect of their fur and feathers. Is that right?
That's absolutely correct.
So what happens if they do that when they're coated with oil? They presumably eat some of the oil.
Mm-hmm. That can also be a problem with these animals. What we tend to see in that situation, it's more a chronic effect. The oil can be considered a toxic substance. So if they're eating the oil by preening, or if they're eating prey that happened to be contaminated by oil, it can cause problems in the organ systems within the animal. Animals can actually die or become injured due to that as well.
I'm talking with Dr. Michael Zaccardi, wildlife veterinarian at the UC Davis Wildlife Health Center. He's helping to supervise the care of birds injured in the Southern California oil spill. How do you clean the birds off?
Well, what we first do is we bring them into the facility and we do a full intake examination, and we give them a couple of days to rest. What we want to do is we want to make sure they're strong enough, they have a good nutritional level, so they're eating well. We don't want to immediately try to clean the animals, because what we've seen is that can actually cause more problems than if we don't clean them. So we actually give them up to 48 hours prior to moving them to wash. We then wash them with, in essence, soapy water. What we're doing is we're moving the soapy water around the feathers, getting the oil off, then rinsing the soap off before we then move them to pools.
Are the birds cooperative? Do they understand that you're trying to help them?
I'm not sure if they understand that we're trying to help them, but what we actually like to see are animals that tend to struggle because that means they're feeling healthy. That means that they have a natural ability to consider us a predator. Usually, if animals aren't feeling well, they tend to be more sedate. They tend to not respond as strongly. So actually, our difficulties in caring for these animals is a good sign for ultimate survival.
And what happens once the birds are cleaned and dried? How long is it before you can release them?
Well, what we're doing is we're washing birds through this facility and we're putting them into pools. And we're assessing those animals every 3 to 4 days to make sure they're regaining normal body weights, normal behaviors. Their medical exams are normal. We're trying to make sure that before we release animals, they're as healthy as possible because we don't want to release animals to the environment and then have them succumb to other problems. So usually it'll take anywhere on the order of 5, 7, 10 days before they're ready to then be released to the environment.
Do you have 1,000 birds at the bird center?
We don't currently have 1,000 birds because unfortunately some of those animals either died in care or were humanely euthanized. We have approximately 800 animals here at the facility, 500 or so which are oiled and awaiting wash, and about 200 to 300 animals that have been washed and waiting to be released.
I'm trying to imagine what this must look like. It must be quite a sight to see all these hundreds and hundreds of birds and animals being cleaned and dried.
It is a fairly pretty remarkable sight. We do have indoor facilities. We do have to keep these animals warm when they're here and have oil on them because the animals do need to maintain a high body temperature. So those animals are in specially designed pens in the facility. We have the animals out in pools outside. So there are pools not only in our yard but in the parking lot in the front of the facility. This facility was designed to handle up to 1,000 birds, so we do have the capability to handle quite a few animals. In this certain instance, they hit very hard, very fast, so we've had the ability to take this specifically designed facility and modify it so that we're able to care for the animals in the best way possible.
Do you think you'll get many more birds?
We certainly hope not, but if we do, we're definitely ready to care for them. We've investigated the ability to use temporary facilities to house animals should that happen. We've investigated bringing additional pools and staff in should that happen. One thing nice in California, and this is the only place in the world that has the system that is set up here, is we actually have 12 specifically designed facilities throughout the state. So should this facility exceed its capacity, we have the ability to activate an additional facility.
And this is all part of the Oiled Wildlife Care Network, I guess.
Absolutely.
Which is funded by fees that were levied on oil companies. Is
yes.
that correct?
Initially. Currently, it's cost neutral to be able to maintain the network on an ongoing basis.
And finally, how much longer do you think you and others from UC Davis will be down in San Pedro?
We expect to be here at least 3 to 4 weeks additional. It actually will take longer to care for some of the animals in care. We're hoping that we will not be going at this level and at this scope for that entire 4 weeks, but we're definitely able to do that as long as the animals need us.
Well, best wishes to you and everyone in San Pedro.
Well, great. Thank you, Jeffrey.
Thank you. That's Dr. Michael Zicardi, wildlife veterinarian at the UC Davis Wildlife Health Center. He's helping supervise the care of birds injured in the Southern California oil spill. And that's Insight for today. Tomorrow, I'll talk with Celtic fiddler Jamie Laval. He's playing in the Bay Area and the foothills this week. He'll bring in his fiddle and the guitarist from his band as we hear and talk about his music. Coming up in a minute on the KXJZ stations, a U.S. military mission in Asia is bringing food to tsunami victims, and it's providing a morale boost for American soldiers, some just returned from Iraq. That story and the day's news are next on The World. I'm Jeffrey Callison. Insight's technical director is Mark Jones. Our senior producer is Benjamin Jonas Keeling. Thank you for joining us. One of the premier Celtic fiddlers on the international music scene today is touring our region. I'm Jeffrey Callison. On the next Insight, Jamie Laval will join me to talk about old music styles from the UK and Ireland and how he modernizes them for contemporary audiences. He'll also perform live in our studio. Join me for Insight.
Tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the KXJZ stations.